we've done interviews in communities where not one woman we talked to was not a survivor of sexual assault, all the way from, you know, the 10-year-old great-granddaughter to the great-grandmother at 90-whatever years old.
My name is Auburn Remington, and I am a reporter for the Daily Universe. I recently spoke with Tara DeMant, the director of the Gender, Sexuality, and Identity Program at Amnesty International, about the crisis of sexual violence against Native women in America. Tara has over 15 years of experience on global gender issues and has advocated for human rights in the United Nations, the White House, State Department, Department of Defense, USAID, Capitol Hill, and with many foreign governments, to name a few. I found Tara's views on the current situation insightful and interesting, and I believe you will too.
A little bit about your role in advocating for Indigenous women's rights.
Sure. So Amnesty International is a grassroots human rights organization, and we've been around since the 60s. And we have a broad mandate, right, which is all rights for all people. So we work on a number of issues. But what we also know at Amnesty International is though all people have the same basic rights, people have different access to the rights depending on who they are, and so different people are impacted differently by rights violations. About 10 years ago, we here at Amnesty USA, out of the U.S. office, launched research and a report and advocacy called Maze of Injustice, which was, you know, which told us what Native American and Alaskan Native advocates had known for a long, long time, that rape in Indian country, rates of rape are astronomical, and it's really a human rights crisis and a public health crisis. So Native women in the U.S. are 2.5 times more likely to be raped or assaulted than non-Native women. And this is just, I mean, it's really hard to imagine, particularly when the rates of assault are already so high in the U.S., that that Native women suffer this disproportionately. And that's not an accident, right? It's not sort of a coincidence that that Native women have much higher rates of sexual assault. And it's not a coincidence for a number of reasons. One, it's a part of the legacy of colonialism that Native people still deal with every day. And part of that is non-Native people's attitudes towards Native people, Native women particularly, and then also the ways that U.S. law and policies impact Indigenous people differently than they impact non-Indigenous people here in the United States. So, for example, a non-Native woman is most likely to be assaulted or raped by, a Native woman is most likely to be assaulted or raped by a non-Native man. 85%, or if not more, of these assaults are done by non-Native men. And that matters for a number of reasons, not only obviously as we try to prevent such assaults from happening, but also then the way that tribes and communities and the U.S. government is able to deal with these assaults in the justice system. So, until very recently, non-Native people couldn't even be held in Native jails. So if I, as a non-Native person, walked onto a reservation territory, Indian country, and committed a crime, I couldn't be held by the local authorities. So then some maybe state official would have to drive in from 100 miles away maybe and get there, or a federal official from even further away, someone from the FBI. And the FBI is not spending their time trying these cases, right? So you have already a culture of impunity set up. So we've been working since 2007 and the launch of that report on a number of issues. Obviously, our ultimate goal is to ensure that all people, and Native women particularly, and survivors, have the right to the basic right to freedom from violence, and particularly sexual violence. And that means ensuring, one, that there's a way that they can report the crimes and work with police if they so choose at their local level, that those crimes are then prosecuted, and that there's justice that can come from that. And then the other then really immediate thing is that Native women can receive just basic post-rape care. What else we found, other than the just massive rates of sexual assault and the absolute failure of the U.S. judicial system and policing system, was that Native women were very unlikely to get basic post-rape care. So, you know, if you're assaulted, you walk into a hospital or a clinic, you need a rape kit, and you need that rape kit for any number of reasons, but you certainly need it if you're ever going to go to trial. And what happens is, for many Native women, when they walk into Indian Health Service, There's no rape kit. There's no basic post-rape care. And so that incident of trauma already they're dealing with on a health level, and they will never be able to walk that through the criminal justice system if they so choose. As a Native people, you can look at something like what happened at Standing Rock as a very recent example that was very, very public. Most of the times that there are interactions with non-Native governments and Native people, that's not very public, right? And what we see is that type of racism over and over and over again. So in many examples. But also, there's total impunity for white people, particularly walking onto Indian country and walking onto tribal land and committing crimes. And that's because U.S. law is specifically written to protect non-Native people from Native justice. And so, you know, many tribes have their own court system, and they have their own police, and they have, you know, this community in towns, they have their own systems of doing things, and non-Native perpetrators aren't beholden to those, despite multiple treaties that the U.S. has historically signed and is beholden to with tribes, saying that they will abide by that, right? So in the past and continually, there's just been total impunity for non-Native perpetrators. So since 2010, when the Tribal Law and Order Act was passed, which is something we fought really hard for, there's been some improvement there. So, for example, non-Native perpetrators can be held in tribal jails. Some of them can be tried by tribal courts. Like, it's not a perfect solution, right? But at least it was somewhat happening. But what we found is, like, though that's technically the law, it's not been implemented, right? That the federal government has not made those changes clear to tribes. And tribes depend on federal government for funding, right? So the tribe has to abide by all these very strict and often contradictory laws and codes to make sure that they don't lose federal funding. And to be very clear, the reason that tribes depend on federal funding is because the U.S. government has set up tribes and moved them specifically so that they are dependent on that money, right? So what happens is it's this absolute maze of who's in charge of what and how someone who's seeking justice actually goes about doing that. And so for survivors of sexual violence, what's happened again and again is they go to IHS, just any health service or local health service. They try and get a rape kit. Let's say that they're very lucky, which is very rare, and they do. And that rape kit gets stored properly, which almost never happens. And in fact, gets turned over, which again, it were very unlikely to happen. Even if all those things magically happen, which everyone has a basic right to, what's happening is the FBI has to try that case. And they're not. They're not flying out to South Dakota to try these cases. They have what they think are bigger fish to fry. They want to do much more splashy type of work. So ultimately, there's total impunity for these types of crimes against Native women, and it creates this culture of repeat offenders who are coming on and off of tribal land and perpetrating. We've done interviews in communities where not one woman we talked to was not a survivor of sexual assault, all the way from, you know, the 10-year-old great-granddaughter to the great grandmother at 90 whatever years old.
So you described really well the maze of injustice, that kind of interrelation between the jurisdictions of Native, state, and federal court being so tricky because nobody knows who has jurisdiction and where, and it can take a long time. So thanks for that. And kind of going on, you described how the Tribal Law and Order Act was passed, mm-hmm. and that has improved things a little bit. What else has been done to improve things since 2007, if any?
Yeah, so unfortunately at a systemic level, not a lot. I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, Native advocates, both Alaskan Native and Native American advocates, have been working on this issue a long time, and so that there's a lot of work going on, particularly at the tribal and regional level, right? And a lot of those changes involve community healing and health centers and trying to work with whatever resources they have and making solutions that make sense for them. So I want to point out that that work has been happening for a long time. And so there's a lot of work on the ground trying to address the situation, trying to make sure that communities are able to support and report and, you know, support whatever systems that they have in place. But the problem is that this type of crime and this type of human rights violation will continue to happen over and over and over again if there aren't systemic changes, right? If there continues to be impunity for non-Native perpetrators, which again make up 85% of these assaults against Native women, then we're not going to see a change. So unfortunately, at the federal level, there hasn't been much change, and we've been working continually with our Native allies to try and get the federal government, frankly, to care, to really do their jobs. You know, for example, in 2010 with the tribal law and order act. Again, it's perfect, and it doesn't cover everything. It doesn't actually even cover sex crime. It's DV, right? So there's a lot of holes in it. But even the parts that it does cover, they haven't been implemented. It's 10 years later. So this is 2018, right? Seven, eight years later. There's been very few changes. And this was a law that was passed. You know, we worked our butts off to get a law that was passed. Congress finally passes this law. Then President Obama signs it. And we're like, okay, good. At least we'll have this little, again, imperfect, you know, what we'll be building towards change. And the government itself has put out a report, multiple reports saying, you know, this, nothing's changed. There's a government office that everybody should know about called the Government Accountability Office, GAO. All they do are reports on government accountability. The government said it would do X. Has it done X? So there are multiple GAO reports which are like, yeah, the government said it would do X, and X has not happened. And frankly, it hasn't happened because there's no political consequence for it. There's absolutely no political consequence for rape and murder of Indian women. There's no political downside for that for people. I don't think that it's every politician wants it to happen, certainly, but there's no consequence for not addressing it. Indian Health Service is, you know, the main provider for health services for Native women, and this is on or off reservations. And it's important to know that most Native Americans in the contiguous United States don't live on reservations. They live in cities. But many of them still depend on Indian Health Service, which is like the VA, for example, for veterans. Indian Health Service hasn't prioritized this work, and they haven't prioritized making solutions to this. Now, they're also only 50% funded. They have a budget of whatever it is, and Congress year after year only provides 50% of that funding. And they do that because it's a low priority. They've got other things they think are more important, right? So there's really been no consequence, and the federal government has done very little. So it's very, very complicated, but the first thing is that no one seems to care that can make a change, I think, which is one of the things that's really important about anyone who's listening, is particularly in Utah, which is, you know, contacting your elected official. And at the House level and at the Senate levels, and you have, you know, outgoing and incoming senators, contacting them to make sure that they know that you care about this. Because most of the people who in the Senate and the House who are on the Indian Affairs Committee or the Indian Insular and Alaska Native Affairs Subcommittee in the House, that's really where Congress does its job. In theory, it could be any senator, but really it's those committees. Those people tend to be from the West, right, for lots of historic reasons. So, you know, out in Utah, you have a particular, I think, opportunity to really make impact here, which is to call your elected officials and be like, God, I heard about what's going on. You know, Congress passed a law. Why isn't it being implemented?
Yes, totally. I love that. So do you think that is the best thing for an average person to help, just contacting our elected officials? Would that be the most beneficial thing we could do?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the most beneficial thing that someone could do is just immediately is to pick up the phone and dial the Capitol switchboard. And so you can dial one number for all of your representatives, and I'll give it to you in a second here, which is, and make that call just so that they know that you care and you expect them to do something about it. You know, the number is 202-224-3121, and that's the number that you call. You get the DC Capitol switchboard, and you can say, connect me to Senator whomever, or connect me to Representative whomever. If someone doesn't know who the representative is, you can give them your zip code, and they'll tell you, and they'll connect you. It's important. It's easiest for someone who represents you to do what you want when you tell them what it is specifically,
yeah.
Right? So in this case, we've already passed a law, so you can't even say, will you vote for this, right? Because they've already voted for it or against it, but it's already passed. So what we're calling
more of
what
you implement
is
kind of,
yeah, we need to implement this, which is like, I'm hearing that, like, I'm really concerned about this issue, and calling just to tell someone you care about something still really matters. But certainly what your listeners can say is, you know, I'm calling because of the high rates of sexual violence against Native women in the U.S. and I want to know what Senator Lee or Senator whomever is going to do about this. I'm particularly concerned that, you know, Native women can't access basic post-rape care. Will the senator consider investigating this and writing a letter to Indian Health Service, right? One of the, we've been trying to get Indian Health Service to be responsive about this, and we really need congressional pressure. But the other thing that people can do, and I think this is really important, particularly for non-Native people, is to learn more about these issues. And I know that a lot of folks also start with, like, learn more. And we need people to take action, too. But it's really critical that non-Native people start seeing Native people, right? That when we look at the laws and policies that get passed, whether whether it's around rape care or whatever, that when we see that oftentimes it doesn't mean including Native women. So I know that it matters because they're doing the groundwork, like they're doing the hard work, right, which is in their communities trying to repair and rebuild the lives of people who've been assaulted, who've had to live with this violence, and who are fighting really hard to make sure that they and their children and their communities have strong and healthy futures. So we work with multiple advocates, and I know that this matters because it's work that they do tirelessly and often invisibly. And so, you know, one of the things, Amnesty, it's not invisible, right? We have a big brand and a big name, and we have more access, so we can, put out a report saying things that surprised literally zero people in Indian country because they know this, they live this. But even just putting out that report helped elevate that issue to give more visibility and to give visibility certainly within the movement, but most especially in the halls of power and decision makers. So I know that that's meaningful and impactful. And also the other way, though, which is like we learn from the folks on the ground doing this work as we try and make law and policy change, because we're not first responders, we're not direct services. But as we work with people making the change in their own communities, we also learn what human rights looks like in real time, right, for real, as opposed to like a law I look at and try and make sound the best it possibly can for human rights. Like, well, what does that actually look like in someone's life? Like, when I say I want everyone to have human rights, it's this very lovely idea, and I can feel really good about this idea. But then if you were like, well, what does that actually look like? Like, this is how we know, right, is working with people who on the ground are trying to live lives of dignity and wholeness. And so that learning relationship goes both ways.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree. Well, thank you so much.